From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ira Gershwin was born 100 years ago today. Tonight in Manhattan, Carnegie Hall will host a birthday tribute. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate the life and lyrics of Ira Gershwin with Robert Kimball, artistic director of Ira Gershwin's estate and editor of the book of Gershwin's complete lyrics. A Charlie Brown Christmas will be broadcast for the 31st time on December 19th. There's also a new line of Peanuts books published for the Christmas season. We'll feature a 1990 interview with the creator of Peanuts, Charles Schulz. And TV critic David Bianculli has a warning for us about this weekend's four-hour production of Samson and Delilah. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Wall Street stock prices are slowly recovering from the thumping they took this morning. Currently, the Dow is down more than 60 points in very heavy trading. The blue chips are off by more than 140 points in the first half hour of trading. Investors are worried that the Federal Reserve might raise interest rates to slow the economy's expansion. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan implied in a speech last night that a raise in short-term interest rates might be forthcoming. He suggested the U.S. stock market was being driven by irrational exuberance. A few hours after he made his remark, the Tokyo stock market dropped by nearly 700 points. All Asian markets closed down today, and the sell-off continued a few hours later in Europe. Wall Street continues to react to the Greenspan speech. Analyst Robert Diedrich says he's not sure that Greenspan had any specific purpose in his remarks.
He didn't really do anything more than the obvious. Let's not try to read any great message in here. But, of course, whenever Alan Greenspan sneezes, people figure that he must have had a purpose. They say, well, Alan Greenspan is trying to send a signal. Whether he was or not, we don't know. But there are people who thought he might be in any event, and that's all it takes.
Investors are also considering today's report on the national unemployment rate. The Labor Department says joblessness rose by 0.2% in November, and 118,000 new jobs were created. The report was less optimistic than analysts had expected. In a separate report, factory orders rose 0.9% in October. That's the seventh advance this year. The report was led by a strong jump in demand for computers and other electronic equipment. For the second day in a row, bad weather has forced NASA to postpone the landing of the space shuttle Columbia. That means the astronauts will spend another day in space. But Pat Duggins of member station WMFE says that doesn't pose a safety problem for the crew.
If you look toward the back end of the shuttle's cargo bay when it's open, you'll notice there's a big rack back there with a number of tanks. That's called an extended duration orbiter pallet, or an EDO pallet. With that, the shuttle should be able to stay up until maybe Monday or Tuesday if they really have to.
The landing delay means Columbia will set a record for the longest shuttle flight ever. Mother Teresa's doctors say she is still improving, but she won't be leaving the hospital for home this weekend. The Nobel Peace Prize winner remains in unstable condition with an irregular heartbeat. She's still got some chest congestion as well. The frail nun spent about 5 minutes taking a short walk yesterday, but she was up past midnight chatting with nuns from her order. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 67 points at 63.70. This is NPR. A published report quotes retired General Norman Schwarzkopf as saying he doesn't think Iraqi chemical weapons are related to Gulf War illnesses. He told the New York Times that he doesn't know of any incident in which troops were exposed to chemicals. But United Nations investigators say they have confirmed the presence of the nerve gas sarin. They say it was at an Iraqi weapons dump that was blown up by U.S. troops at the end of the Gulf War. The Pentagon's coordinator for Gulf War illnesses says investigators drilled into a rocket and the gas came out. A Palestinian official says a summit may take place as early as this weekend between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. They're expected to work on a final agreement for Israel's troop withdrawal from the West Bank town of Hebron. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Jerusalem.
After months of on-again, off-again negotiations, it appears that Israel and the Palestinians are now close to an agreement, and Israeli troops may soon withdraw from the West Bank town of Hebron. One PLO official said a summit between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was likely to take place sometime this weekend in Cairo. But no time has been set, nor has such a meeting been confirmed by either Israeli or Palestinian officials. The talks over Hebron have been deadlocked for the past few weeks, but in recent days, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators report substantial progress, especially over the issue of security arrangements for the 400 or so Jewish settlers who live in Hebron, a city with a Palestinian population of more than 100,000. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
There are new federal rules in place for real estate agents and home sellers. They're required to tell prospective renters or buyers if the home they're getting into has lead-based paint. Fines can be imposed for failing to do this. Lead poisoning attacks the system and can cause brain damage. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ira Gershwin was born 100 years ago today. On this archive edition, we join in the celebration of his life and lyrics. He wrote some of his greatest songs with his brother George, like "S'Wonderful," "Nice Work If You Can Get It," "A Foggy Day," "Love Walked In," "Love Is Here to Stay," "I Got Rhythm," "Fascinating Rhythm," and "Lady Be Good." After George's death in 1937, Ira went on to collaborate with other great composers. He worked with Harold Arlen on the musical A Star Is Born, with Jerome Kern on Cover Girl, and with Kurt Weill on Lady in the Dark. Ira Gershwin died in 1983 at the age of 86. Music theater historian Robert Kimball is the artistic advisor for the Ira Gershwin estate. We'll hear an interview we recorded in 1994 when Kimball edited a book of Ira Gershwin's complete lyrics, including the lyrics to many previously unpublished songs. Fred Astaire introduced many of Gershwin's early songs. Let's get started with Astaire singing "S'Wonderful."
S'Wonderful, S'Marvelous, that you should care for me. Oh, S'Awful Nice, S'Paradise, S'What I love to see. You've made my life so glamorous. You can't blame me for feeling amorous. Oh, S'Wonderful, S'Marvelous, that you should care for me.
Robert Kimball, welcome to Fresh Air. How well did you know Ira Gershwin, and how did you get to know him?
I knew Ira really quite well. I started working with him in 1972 when my friend and partner Alfred Simon, who had been rehearsal pianist in Of the I Sing in 31, and I asked him if we could do a book about himself and his brother. And we went out to spend some time with him. We spent many days in the house. And the first day I met him, he took me aside and asked me very, well, I would describe it as somewhat haltingly but insistently, to make the book entirely about his brother George and not about himself. He saw himself to a certain degree as the custodian of George's legacy. Now, when I worked with him, he would come downstairs to his pool room, billiard room, office about noon, and he would say to us, "Boys, am I disturbing you?" And, of course, we were so happy to see him. And he would reminisce a lot because he knew we loved the old stories, and we would ask him questions. And on many wonderful occasions, he would ask Al Simon, who was a superb pianist and who knew, as I say, a lot of Gershwin work, if Al remembered particular songs. And one day he felt particularly lively and asked Al if he would mind playing through the score of Of the I Sing. And so we went up to their living room, and at George Gershwin's own piano, Ira Gershwin sat, cigar in his hand, with his eyes closed, and Al began with the overture, and Ira sang the entire score all the way through, and it was certainly one of the most memorable experiences of my life, hearing Ira sing the wonderful, wonderful songs that he and George had written, and it made us all very happy.
I'd like to go back to 1917, to the very first published lyric written by Ira Gershwin, and you reprint this lyric in your new book. And this lyric was actually a parody, a satire. The song was called "You May Throw All the Rice You Desire." I'm just going to read a little bit of the verse, because Gershwin wrote this apparently as a spoof, and it's I think a pretty funny spoof of a type of turn-of-the-century song. "The ceremony was over, and all was happy and gay. The blushing bride and her lover to the steps did wend their way. Their young friends them had proceeded, and had formed a merry plot, although the older folks pleaded, the younger folks heeded them not." And so on and so on. And then it goes to the refrain, "You may throw all the rice you desired, but please, friends, throw no shoes, for 'twill surely arouse my ire if you cause my wife one bruise." What I find particularly amusing about this spoof is that Gershwin became so wonderful about, you know, with using colloquial lines and slang and writing lyrics the way people spoke. It's great that his first published lyric was a parody of lyrics written in the way people didn't speak, written in a stilted prose.
Terry, that's a very interesting point that you made. And indeed, if we think of Ira Gershwin's contributions as a lyricist, it's so much his ability to take cliches, shopworn phrases, and the way, as you say, people actually spoke to one another in ordinary situations, and to somehow bring those into lyrics and to mate them with this incredible music of George's to give them timeless expression. And George just loved the way Ira did that, and that he really responded very beautifully to it. He could almost anticipate some of Ira's ideas, and he would come up with playful thoughts of his own to give Ira to set. And I think that's one of Ira's great contributions to lyric writing, is that it made it less formal. It had a kind of formal sort of idea that you're telling a story, a long verse in the old days, and then a very short refrain that was repeated. And the story, of course, was very much in the verse. And Ira worked to loosen things up a bit and to make them go easier for people who would sing them as well.
I think maybe one of his most famous songs that uses colloquial speech is "Swonderful."
Well, there, by eliminating the "its" and bringing the "s" and the "w" together, sort of a device that he had used earlier in a song called "Sunny Disposition," where he shortened the words "sunny disposition" to "sunny disposition," all the rhymes that occur. Again, it by making it "Swonderful," you get the feeling of the ecstasy without the formality of saying, "Gee, it's wonderful," which is fine, but not like "Swonderful."
Ira Gershwin had wonderfully clever rhymes, but on the other hand, he was capable of abandoning conventional rhymes, which he did on one of his most famous songs, "I Got Rhythm." You want to tell the story about why he didn't use a rhyme on that?
Well, he had a number of thoughts about that. He found that the phrases were very short, and he thought that to try to rhyme it just didn't work. The song didn't work, and he had things like roly-poly rhyming with ravioli and some of the dummy lyrics that he put together in a search to find the song, and he just finally came up with a pattern that tended to work better by not having these kinds of repetitions, so that each phrase had a distinctive quality on its own. And certainly when Ethel Merman sang it, which was in her Broadway debut in 1930, and you had this fabulous pit band that included Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman and other greats, later, of course, great band leaders in the pit, it was one of the most exciting numbers in the history of the American musical theater.
Yeah, you said that he had written a dummy lyric just to try different rhyme schemes to see how they worked. And so the dummy lyric is just to try out certain rhyme schemes. And do you want to quote the dummy lyric that he had come up with, which convinced him that this kind of rhyme scheme wasn't going to work in the song?
If you can imagine the tune, we all know the tune, so it's sort of hard to forget the tune of "I Got Rhythm," but it went roly-poly, eating solely, ravioli, better watch your diet or bust, lunch or dinner, you're a sinner, please get thinner, losing all that fat is a must. That's that didn't somehow work as a song, but it gave him the idea of the kind of thing he was trying for, short words. And each phrase had to be really complete in itself. You know, "I got rhythm, I got music." You know, who could ask for anything more, which is certainly one of the most famous lines in all of his songs. Who could ask for anything more?
You've brought a record with you of George Gershwin performing the song that he collaborated on with his brother. Would you introduce the record for us?
I'd be happy to, Terry. In 1934, when George had begun work on the opera Porgy and Bess, he really needed income. So he went on the radio, and he had a radio show which was sponsored by Phenamint, the laxative, for which he was teased constantly by many people, and later said, well, if there hadn't been Phenamint, there would have been no Porgy and Bess. But on the show, he would play his own music and introduce his songs as well as music of others. And we have a few acetates that survived that Ira Gershwin had, and one of them has a marvelous performance prefaced with an introduction. We hear George Gershwin speaking, mentioning the song I Got Rhythm, mentioning his brother Ira. We hear an incredible, inventive performance, which undoubtedly he did on the spur of the moment during the performance because he could do that so well and that song was so close to him. So from 1934, we hear George Gershwin playing I Got Rhythm.
But right now, I want to play for you a composition of mine that brings up the pleasantest memories. It's I Got Rhythm from a show called Girl Crazy. Maybe you saw it a few seasons ago. Again, I had the pleasure of working with my brother Ira, who supplied the lyrics. Anyway, let's try it.
Too bad George didn't sing and couldn't sing his brother's lyric.
Well, he did sing and times when he and Ira were trying to put things together, and Todd Duncan said laughingly when he heard them audition songs from Porgy and Bess for him that they had the god-awfulest voices he'd ever heard, the two of them. But he said at the same time that it was so incredible and so real to hear how they presented their songs. And Ira did, of course, from time to time, demo his own work. And we have, obviously, some examples of that where he worked with Harold Arlen and Burton Lane, Kurt Weill, and others, and making some recordings of songs for movies particularly, and some for shows as well, that would help the performers and the arrangers have a sense of the material.
Well, why don't we listen to Ira Gershwin singing one of his own songs and see what kind of voice he has. And you've brought something with you.
Yes.
With Ira Gershwin singing Harold Arlen at the piano, a song that they wrote together.
This is a song written in 1936 for Fred Astaire for Shall We Dance, and it's called Hi Ho. And it had a very specific idea that Fred would kind of walk through the street seeing this girl on a poster and would then respond to it. The scene was never shot, and the song was never, obviously, in the film. And over 30 years later, a number of friends of Ira's had said that really it should get published. It was such a wonderful song. But he occasionally would do it at parties, and I think this is from a party performance that Harold Arlen, a great composer and performer in his own right, is at the piano, and we hear Ira Gershwin singing Hi Ho, a 1936 song written for Fred Astaire.
At last it seems I found her. Now I won't be happy till my arms are around her. Hi Ho. Oh, hi. If a kiss she'd only throw me, oh my. Her charm, her smile so sweet and dimply, I want them or I'll simply die.
Ira Gershwin singing his lyric. The melody was written by George Gershwin. Harold Arlen is at the piano. Well, you wouldn't say Ira Gershwin has a great voice, but he sings with gusto and can certainly put his lyric across.
Terry, this song actually was, I think, the first song that George and Ira wrote during the last year of George's life. When they arrived in Hollywood, I think they were still at one of the hotels before they found the house on Roxbury where they lived. And 11 months was all that George Gershwin had left. And if we think about what they wrote during that 11-month period, you know, Slap That Bass, I've Got Beginner's Luck, They All Laughed, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, They Can't Take That Away From Me, I Can't Be Bothered Now, Stiff Upper Lip, Things Are Looking Up, A Foggy Day, and then the last, even to the very end, George's last song, after Love Walked In and others, he then, without completing the verse, his last song was Love Is Here to Stay. All those were written in less than a year, and they are among the greatest songs written in this century by any writers.
Since we just heard Arlen accompanying Ira Gershwin, why don't we talk about a song that Arlen wrote with Ira Gershwin? And I'm thinking of The Man That Got Away.
Well, I think we should say that, certainly to let people know that when George died, it took a long time for Ira to get back to work, and it was listening to some recordings that Fred Astaire made of their songs that made him believe that maybe he should try again. And then during the rest of his years, he worked with a number of great writers, including Jerome Kern, with whom he wrote Long Ago and Far Away, a great standard. And he wrote film scores with Harold Arlen, and one of the songs from Star Is Born is one of the greatest songs that Judy Garland ever sang, of course, The Man That Got Away, and it is a fabulous song, and I probably should say nothing more. We should hear it.
Why don't we hear Harold Arlen singing The Man That Got Away?
The night is bitter. The stars have lost their glitter. The winds grow colder. And suddenly you're older, and all because of the man that got away. No more his eager call, the writings on the wall, the dreams you dream have all gone astray.
That's Harold Arlen singing a wonderful song with music by Arlen and a lyric by Ira Gershwin. It's so Ira Gershwin that he explains why the lyric became The Man That Got Away, as opposed to the more grammatically correct The Man Who Got Away. Do you want to explain his explanation for it?
The Man That Got Away is, of course, an interesting title, and people always wanted to sing it The Man Who Got Away, but Ira didn't like that, and he said that the title had come as a paraphrase of something that he had heard and is often used, fisherman's, you should have seen the one that got away. That meaning it's somewhat larger in scope, wasn't just a person, it was a whole world that left, not just an individual who departed from one's life.
My guest is Robert Kimball, artistic advisor for the Ira Gershwin Estate and editor of the book of Gershwin's complete lyrics. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ira Gershwin was born 100 years ago today. Let's get back to our 1994 interview with the artistic advisor of his estate, Robert Kimball. Did Ira Gershwin have a different working method when he was collaborating with his brother George than he did when he was collaborating later on with such composers as Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen, Kurt Weill?
Yes, and Ira and George were so close and had grown up together that they could speak to each other any hour, day or night. Perhaps one of them was having trouble sleeping and would then come into the other and say, let's go to work, I think I have an idea. You couldn't really do that with someone as austere as Jerome Kern or even Kurt Weill. But Ira was, according to everyone who's worked with him, the most agreeable and companionable of people. They all loved working with him. They loved to tease him. One of the things that both Harold Arlen and Burton Lane used to tell me was that the way to really get Ira's goat was to tell him they'd been given an opportunity to do a film score which required at least five ballads. And Ira would moan. He'd say, oh, no, no, not another score with ballads. I don't like writing ballads. Well, of course, he wrote some of the finest ever written, but he hated to go at it because he said it was really hard work to come up with a fresh and new approach to I Love You or I Once Loved You and You No Longer Love Me or whatever the particular theme was. And so they had fun with him about that.
You knew Ira Gershwin in the last years of his life. Was he still writing songs? Is he still listening to a lot of music? What was his life like at the end?
Well, Ira actually stopped writing in the mid-50s and really retired. He retired and then he wrote his book, Lyrics, on several occasions, which had 104 of his lyrics. This book has 730. And he was really retired. I mean, it was amazing. In their early years, George and Ira moved every few months. Ira counted that in the first 16 years of his life, they moved 28 times. That's really quite a lot of moving.
Sure is.
3 months' rent would take the Gershwin family from one part of New York to another. Ira really completely shut down in a sense. He didn't go out. And when I knew him, he rarely went beyond the backyard or the front walk for a walk. He basically found everything he needed inside with television. He could watch sports events. He could read. He could entertain his friends and people came to see him. He could write letters to young children. The thing I think he loved doing most, aside from reminiscing and really telling stories about the old days, which he did very, very well, was to receive a letter from a child asking a question, innocent question, well, how did you work with your brother or what is songwriting like? He would spend days formulating an answer to a letter like that.
So you think he stayed home a lot in part in reaction to all the changing of homes that he did when he was growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I think he did. And he sort of recognized it, and he just did it that way. That was what he wanted to do. I mean, before that, he used to go to Vegas and gamble a little bit and go to the track. But he had the pool table, and his friends would come in. And then the main thing of the later years, the main social event of the later years was the poker game on Saturday night, which a number of friends participated in. But in the later years, Ira really became very reclusive. Michael Feinstein, who worked for him for 6 years as his musical secretary, would go up to Ira's bedroom and had a little piano installed where Michael could play and sing and entertain Ira and speak with him. And increasingly just, got older and stayed in his room and rarely even left his room in the last years. I'm going to talk on the phone quite a bit. And the last phone conversation that I had with him was right after the opening of the show My One and Only, and while he had stopped writing, he was willing to make one or two word changes on a lyric for Tommy Toon, and he changed Strike Up the Band and a couple of other lyrics to help the show. And when the show opened and was a hit, he was absolutely stunned, and for the first time in his life was receiving checks that were the kinds that his younger colleagues were receiving. He was just absolutely floored by it. And that was the very last project that he had worked on, and that was in 1982, and it opened, I think, in 83.
Robert Kimball is the artistic advisor to the Ira Gershwin Estate and editor of the book of Gershwin's complete lyrics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the creator of Peanuts, Charles Schulz. A Charlie Brown Christmas will have its annual broadcast later this month on CBS. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Samson and Delilah, a 4-hour movie that will air this weekend. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 46 years ago, a depressed, insecure kid named Charlie Brown took his place next to Lil Abner, Steve Canyon, and Prince Valiant on the comics pages of the dailies. Peanuts has since become one of the most famous comic strips in the world, but Charlie Brown has always stayed kind of unhappy.
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel. I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
That's from A Charlie Brown Christmas, which was first broadcast in 1965 and has since become an annual TV tradition. CBS will broadcast it for the 31st time on December 19th. A new line of Peanuts books and interactive books collecting new and old material is being published by HarperCollins. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1990 interview with the creator of Peanuts, Charles Schulz. We spoke to Schulz from his studio in Santa Rosa, California.
Do you put in things into Peanuts that you think and feel now, or do you feel that you rely on memory about how children react to things?
I don't think much about children, actually, and I don't regard this at all as being a strip for children. I think that drawing a comic strip for children would be a wonderful thing, but I think it would be extremely difficult. I don't know of anybody these days who is drawing a really good strip for children, and in the history of comics, which I suppose could be about 80 years, I can think of only three or four who are ever really drawn for children. So I just draw what I think is funny and what thoughts come to me and what things work out. And I suppose you could say I simply draw for myself.
Now, you get older while the characters you draw stay the same age. Do you think that they've changed as you've grown?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that the characters have changed. I think the entire strip, the whole outlook, is much more mild from what it used to be. I don't think the characters are quite as sarcastic as they used to be, because I probably myself am not quite as sarcastic as I used to be. I think as you grow older, you begin to see both sides of issues more clearly. And my approach is just different, that's all, as I've gotten older.
There's a Peanuts from, I forget the year, it's in the 1950s, where I think it's Linus shows Charlie Brown a scar, and he asks Charlie Brown if he has any scars, and Charlie Brown says, oh, I have lots of them, but they're all mental.
Yeah.
And I think in a way that kind of sums up Charlie Brown's view of life, you know, the mental scars.
Yeah.
Did you find any reluctance in newspapers at the time to take on a subject like depression or mental scars, you know?
No, I don't recall anybody ever complaining about that. What editors were afraid of in those days, much more than now, was the mention of personalities in things. There used to be a very wonderful lady who had a program out of Chicago called Miss Frances. And I used to watch it with my little kids all of the time. And I mentioned her name in a comic strip one day, and some editor complained. He said, we shouldn't be promoting things like that. Well, now people mention almost everything. And of course, comic strip characters are saying things which they never would have said even 10, 12, 15 years ago. They're actually beginning to swear in comic strips now, which I think is a bad policy.
Well, the closest you've come to swearing in a comic is probably Good Grief.
I have discovered in my life that Good Grief and rats will cover almost anything that ever happens to you.
How did you start using Good Grief, which has really become a popular part of the vocabulary?
It was just a natural thing that I always said. If I was playing golf and I missed a 3-foot putt, I might say, "Oh, good grief!" You know. But I've never been one who swore. I've never liked ugly words. I have nothing against I'm not a purist in that way, but I like words to a certain extent. I'm not well educated so that I'm an expert on them, but I've never cared for any type of ugly language, even words that are not considered swearing words.
Do you think of the characters in Peanuts as each representing a different side of your own character?
I think there's no doubt about it. I doubt that it would be possible to do something every day with a group of characters such as I have without each one of those characters being a little bit of myself or being a little bit of the creator. I think this is the only way you can do it. This is why I suppose the characters do change little by little. I try to be consistent in their personalities, but I also think that none of us is ever really consistent in the things that we do and say. We all have our little good points and bad points, and this is what the characters have. I kind of like the theory that my son Monty has. He called me one day and he says, "I've been thinking about your characters, you know, and I've come to the conclusion that Charlie Brown is really the smartest one of the whole group." And I had never even thought much about it, but I have a feeling that he's right.
What part of yourself is Charlie Brown about?
Not as much as people like to think. It just makes a good story, of course. I have not been the loser that Charlie Brown has, although I can remember certainly losses in both baseball and golf and hockey that go back 50 years, and I'm still suffering from them. I think Charlie Brown and I are alike in that we are both fanatics about certain things. I was the same sort of little kid that Charlie Brown was. I looked forward to the baseball games that we were going to have, and if it was raining, I would have been the kind that would have stood out in the rain and saying, "Where's everybody going? You know, let's play the game. Come on, let's go." You know, I was just dedicated to things like that, and I suppose it's the dedication to drawing that has kept me going these 40 years, because I am completely dedicated to what I do.
Do you get depressed like Charlie Brown?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've been depressed the last few days.
About
I never quite know why.
About what, do you know?
For one thing, we are in the midst of doing a wonderful ice show here at my ice arena, and there's something about seeing all the beautiful, bright young people out there performing, and I listen to the music. The music brings back memories to me, and I suppose I'm just sensitive to that kind of thing. I don't think I'm any more sensitive than anyone else is, but they do affect me. And little things like that do tend to make me feel depressed. Although Rita Grimsley Johnson wrote a book about me a couple of years ago called Good Grief, and she mentions in there my depression. And I think the use of the word depression is almost wrong. I don't know what word would be more suitable, but I don't think that I am what you would call a really depressed person by any means.
Well, you know, when a child is depressed, like or anxious, like Charlie Brown often is, I think that adults sometimes don't understand it and think, you know, that childhood should be a time when kids are more carefree.
Oh yeah.
I was wondering if you were exposed to a lot of that when you were young, of adults maybe not understanding your moods, and your interior self.
I don't know about the moods, but I think the word anxiety is much more appropriate than depression.
Yeah.
I think I am a very anxious person. Now, my childhood was a good childhood, but there were episodes in our neighborhood where there were some cruel children, a couple of boys, and there's one of them. If I ever see him again sometime, I'm going to kill him. they caused me much unhappiness, and I think this is something that adults tend to forget. It's very difficult out there in the playground to survive. It's a struggle out there. And as we grow older, we drift away from that and we learn how to protect ourselves. But children are defenseless. And if they are forced to be out on that playground and they are too small or they're inadequate in some ways and they just can't defend themselves, it can be a very miserable life.
Now let's get to Lucy. Lucy has a Lucy has a psychiatry booth.
Yeah.
Were you ever in therapy, or do you have any faith in therapy?
I don't know enough about it to say I have faith or not. I went through a few sessions over this anxiety business, but the psychiatric booth is really a takeoff, a parody of the old lemonade stands that used to be in comic strips.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. When I was growing up, every comic strip character at some time or another ran a little lemonade stand. And so I was thinking about that one day, and I thought, well, nowadays it'd be much more practical to have a psychiatric booth, and that's how that all started.
How did you come up with Linus's security blanket?
I would say out of the five children that we had, three of them had blankets, and two of them carried the blankets around until they literally crumbled and disappeared. Little by little, chunks would fall off each day until finally there was nothing left, and that was the end of the blanket, and that's what gave me the idea for it. I was always glad that I was the first one who noticed it and used it, because I know if I had not, that Mort Walker, who was very bright, would have latched onto the same idea.
Now, your father and Charlie Brown's father were both barbers. Now, Charlie Brown has no hair. He has that one little lock that comes out.
I don't think of it as not having hair. I think of it as being hair that is so blonde that it just doesn't, it's not seen very clearly, that's all.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if your father always gave you too close of a shave when he cut your hair.
No, but he always gave me haircuts, and when I went to school, I was always looking very nice. My hair was neatly combed, but the embarrassing thing about that was when I used to go into the shop, and he'd be working on me, and maybe he'd be halfway through my haircut, and a real good customer would come in, and he would say, why don't you just sit over there and wait for a little bit, because I have to wait on this man. It was so embarrassing to sit on the bench with just a half a haircut.
Oh, yeah.
My guest is Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts.
What did you draw before you started doing Peanuts?
I tried several other comic strips. I always wanted to do something about the Foreign Legion for some reason, which is why Snoopy now leads his legionnaires across the desert. And I had another character about a little girl who was kind of a tomboy. I tried to sell her at different times, but it didn't go over. But I discovered little by little, by the few cartoons that I sold to the Saturday Evening Post, that when I drew little kids, these seemed to be the type of cartoons that editors liked the best.
What was the first strip that you did with a Charlie Brown or Charlie Brown kind of character in it? Did it start off as the strip that we know now, or was there a more, was there an earlier version of it?
No, but the original submission to United Features was a panel rather than a strip, so there were no definite characters. And then when I went to New York to sign the contract, I took along a batch of about a half a dozen strips I had been working on just to show them what else I could do. And they said immediately that they would much rather have a strip than a panel, because a strip just is easier to sell, it's easier to market. So then they said, well, you'll have to create some definite characters. So I said, well, that's no problem, because I already knew I liked to draw a little dog. And I just went home and I asked my friend Charlie Brown if I could use his name. And he said that was fine. And so I created Patty and Shermie, and those were the four lead characters. The first strip that ever appeared, I wish I had never drawn. It shows Shermie and Patty sitting on a curb, and they see Charlie Brown coming from a distance. And Shermie says, here comes Charlie Brown. Yes, sir, good old Charlie Brown. And as he walks by, he says, how I hate him. See, that shows what I was doing those days, which I would never do now.
Well, why are you sorry that you drew that, though?
Well, I don't think he should have said something like, how I hate him. It's a little too strong. Nowadays, I think I would make it more mild.
Now, I know that when you first submitted your comic to the syndicate, that they changed the name. They just came up with the name of Peanuts, and you didn't like the name.
Probably the worst title ever thought of for a comic strip, and I always make sure that when I am interviewed that I say this, because I like to get revenge. But it is totally inappropriate. It has nothing to do with what I am drawing. But I don't think the people at the syndicate, even though they were wonderful gentlemen, and I owe them a good deal because we've become close friends, but I don't think they had any comprehension of what I was going to do. I think the difficulty of being a syndicate editor is that you have to realize the potential of this young person who is sitting across from you when you are looking at his or her work. Is this person a fanatic, or is he or she just somebody who's doing something for a lark? And they should have recognized immediately that here they had somebody who was a fanatic and somebody who was really dedicated. They should have listened to me a little more carefully. Fortunately, titles of comic strips are not that important. Who knows that Popeye is really called Thimble Theater? It's really not important.
What's wrong with Peanuts?
Peanuts, in the first place, is insignificant. It indicates something that is not very important. And also, it is not the name of the lead character, which is what I said would deceive people when the strip first began, and it certainly proved to be true. I just hate it when somebody says, "Oh, I liked what Peanuts and his dog did the other day." That drives me crazy.
No, so what title did you want to give it?
I think I would have liked to have called it Good Old Charlie Brown. But as the years have gone on, I realized that Snoopy would simply have been the best name because he has turned out to be the lead character. But we didn't know that, of course, at the time.
Now, have you ever hired artists to draw for you like most people who do newspaper strips end up doing?
I would quit before I'd do that. The only way I suppose that it could happen would be if I had a temporary illness and I simply couldn't keep up the schedule. But even then, I think we would just drop the strip until I became well again. Before I had heart surgery, I worked very hard and I got 3 months ahead on the strip because I didn't know how much time I would lose. As it turned out, I only lost a month. But I hope that no one else ever touches the strip because the strip is me. And this doesn't mean that I'm critical of others who do have assistance. Some of them certainly need them. But I would never want anybody else to do it. And my children feel the same way. And they insisted in putting in our syndicate contract that when I retire or die, the strip goes too, because they said, and I quote, "We don't want anybody else drawing Dad's strip."
Do you have any plans to retire?
All my friends are retiring, and it annoys me to talk to people who are even younger than myself. And I say, "What are you doing these days?" "Oh, I'm retired." "What are you doing?" "Well, what really annoys me, Terry, is when they say, 'Oh, are you still drawing the strip?'" I feel that they should recognize that someone else has not been doing the strip, that it is such a personal strip, such a personal form of creativity, and it really is insulting that they think we could just go out and find somebody else to do it. Now, maybe it could happen, but I like to think, I'm egotistical enough to think that they just can't find somebody else to do it.
Well, I mean, there'd be the very unfortunate option of stopping the strip if you really wanted to retire.
Oh, sure, I can stop at any time.
But obviously you don't want to. I mean, obviously working is an important part of your life.
I don't know how to do anything else, and I don't want to play golf every day. So I suppose what I would like to stop is all of the nuisance things that happen, all of the continual stream of requests that come into the studio for drawings and special appearances and things like that. I've got to try to learn to cut all of that out, and I'm doing the best that I can. In fact, just the other night I said to my wife, "Jeannie, look," I said no 3 times tonight. that was pretty good, I thought.
It's hard for you to say no?
Very hard. And I despise autographing. I hate to say it, but I really despise autographing. But it's bad enough, all the trouble, but then it's the guilt that is laid upon you because you've turned somebody down for autographs. But I just can't stand it anymore.
What's bad about autographing? Is it coming up with something to say or just the whole absurdity of it?
Well, yeah, and my hands shake, and sometimes it's a nuisance. And who wants an autograph a gum wrapper? I had a fella ask me for an autograph over in the parking lot the other day at the mall, and his car was still moving. And he drove by me, and he says, "Hey, aren't you Charles Schultz?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Could I have your autograph?" His car was still moving. I says, "This is ridiculous." And I kept right on walking.
You said your handshakes. Is it embarrassing for you to autograph if your handshakes?
Yeah, very embarrassing. Sometimes I'd like to draw them a little Snoopy, but my hand shakes, and that is embarrassing.
Does that get in the way of cartooning at home?
Yeah, I have to. It's not any worse than it used to be, but I kind of prop one hand against the other, and I can't draw as fast as I used to. I used to be quite facile with the pen. I used to be quite proud of the pen line that I had, But I have to be more careful now. But I just draw a little more slowly, that's all. And I letter very slowly, but I still letter very well and very clearly, I think.
Have you ever wanted to do a strip besides Peanuts?
Yes, I never will. I've often thought that I would have liked to have drawn a strip about real children, with the cartooning not being as exaggerated as it is with mine, with the larger heads and the little tiny bodies. I think there is something there. However, we are now caught in this terrible bind where we have such small space in which to work that it would be almost impossible to do something like that.
Is it loyalty to Peanuts also that would hold you back from doing a different strip?
Yeah, because I like what I have, and I think that every thought that comes to me can be used in the Peanuts strip in some way or another. I never think of something and say, well, gee, I wish I could use that, but it just won't work in my strip. I have a repertory group here that will accommodate anything that I can think of, whether it's something fairly serious, you know, like certain scriptural references, something from the Old Testament, way on down to something really corny, and then I'll give it to Snoopy, and he'll tell Woodstock something which is just absurd and corny, and they both laugh so hard they fall off the doghouse and land on their heads. those things are really fun, and that's what cartooning is all about. I think that cartoonists have to be very much aware of their medium, because you cannot compete with live actors, television actors, movie actors, radio actors, on their own ground. You have to remember that you can do things that they can't do. Cartoon characters can flip over and do things that live actors can't do, but they can do things that we can't do. So you always must be aware of your own medium.
Charles Schulz, he's the creator of Peanuts. Our interview was recorded in 1990. The annual broadcast of A Charlie Brown Christmas is coming up December 19th on CBS. And there's a new line of Peanuts books published by HarperCollins. Coming up, 4 hours of Samson and Delilah. David Bianculli will have a review. This is Fresh Air. Two different cable services, TNT and Showtime, have presented several telemovies and miniseries over the past few years based on the same source, the Old Testament. This Sunday, TNT presents its latest effort, a 4-hour drama called Samson and Delilah. Its cast and director suggests this Samson will be a quality effort, but TV critic David Bianculli suggests otherwise.
I usually spend my time on Fresh Air steering people towards good TV rather than away from bad TV. Bad TV, I figure, is easy to find on your own. But when something sounds like good TV, and even looks like good TV in previews, then doesn't deliver, that's when I think it becomes fair game. That's the case with Samson and Delilah, which looks like a duck, walks like a duck, sounds like a duck, but ends up being a real turkey. One of the reasons expectations are high for this particular biblical drama is the supporting cast. You have Diana Rigg as Samson's mother. You have Michael Gambon from The Singing Detective as the King of the Philistines. And you have Dennis Hopper, who does some of his very best work in made-for-TV movies, as the King's General. Right there, this Samson and Delilah sounds like a winner, but it's not. Hopper attacks his role with an accent and an approach that are equally flat. His general, most of the time, acts like he's heavily tranquilized. Gambon is much better in his role as the king, but the role is so small, it hardly makes a dent. Diana Rigg's part is even smaller, and what she does, a lot of weeping and worrying mostly, isn't impressive. And that came as a shock to me, because in my 21 years as a TV critic, these are the first unflattering words I've ever had to deliver in Diana Rigg's direction. Speaking of direction, that's the other big star name involved here. The director of Samson and Delilah is Nicholas Roeg, who did Don't Look Now and The Man Who Fell to Earth, among other films. Because Samson and Delilah is all about faith and passion and betrayal, he sounds like the perfect guy for the job. His Don't Look Now movie, with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, includes one of the most sensual love scenes ever filmed. But in Samson and Delilah, almost every camera move Roeg makes is wrong. He uses handheld photography and quick cuts that don't belong in a biblical epic. When he stages action scenes, they fall flat. If you want well-directed fight scenes starring an ancient long-haired strongman, watch Hercules instead. Finally, there are the leading man and woman, and I haven't exactly been saving the best till last. Samson is played by Eric Thal. No, I haven't heard of him either. And Delilah is played by Elizabeth Hurley, who is best known up to this point for being Hugh Grant's forgiving significant other and for looking beautiful in perfume commercials. She looks beautiful here, too. Really pretty. But when she and Dennis Hopper and Michael Gambon are in the same scene, the clash of acting styles is pretty severe. Here's Hopper's general suggesting to the king that Delilah be sent to Samson to seduce and betray him.
There is no general on this earth could devise a better plan to lay his enemy low than to capture him by that part of his body in which he is the weakest.
The fish will take the bait. But will the bait agree to the fish?
In fishing, there's only one certainty. You can never be sure of your catch. There's always the danger that the fish may escape with the bait. Is that not so, General?
At the end of this four-hour miniseries, which concludes Wednesday, Samson brings down the house. This TV Samson, though, is really, really weak.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.